I'm Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Apologetics Profile.
Charles Dickens' classic holiday tale, A Christmas Carol, first published in December of 1843, features the money-grubbing Ebenezer Scrooge alone in his darkened bedroom when he begins to hear what sounds like chains being dragged up from his cellar. Somewhat frightened by the chilling sound, Scrooge nevertheless refuses to believe he has heard anything.
"It's humbug still, I won't believe it."
It was at that very moment that what seemed to be an apparition, a ghost of his deceased former business partner, Jacob Marley, passed through Scrooge's heavy wooden bedroom door. Scrooge, terrified, asks what business the spirit has with him. After confirming it was indeed the ghost of Marley, Scrooge still refuses to believe what he is seeing and hearing.
"You don't believe in me," observed the ghost.
"I don't," said Scrooge.
"What evidence would you have of my reality beyond that of your senses?"
I don't know," said Scrooge.
"Why do you doubt your senses?"
"Because," said Scrooge, "a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheats. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. There is more gravy than grave about you, whatever you are."
Scrooge was not much in the habit of cracking jokes, the narrator tells us, nor did he feel in his heart by any means waggish about them. The truth is that he tried to be smart as a means of distracting his own attention and keeping down his terror, for the specter's voice disturbed the very marrow in his bones. End quote. Scrooge's terror may serve as a literary metaphor for what the Apostle Paul proclaims in the first chapter of the book of Romans, namely that though God has clearly revealed himself to us through what he has made, we, in Scrooge-like fashion, suppress that truth in unrighteousness, perhaps out of fear, or sin. It is not just a problem for the unbeliever, however, as the Bible indicts all of humanity as mired in unbelief. One of the aspects of the universe that does seem to haunt the minds of many who do not profess to believe in God is that the universe and biological life seem as though they were designed with a purpose. Consider the words of atheist and biologist Dr. Richard Dawkins, who defines biology as, quote, "the study of complicated things that have the appearance of having been designed with a purpose," end quote. Dawkins says that things appear designed, but he chalks up this design to a mere illusion. Consider the thoughts, though, of atheist and cosmologist Dr. Lawrence Krauss in his latest book, The Edge of Knowledge. Krauss likewise sees design in the universe as he observes, quote, "Viewed under a magnifying glass or a microscope, snowflakes are beautiful renderings of the hidden order of nature. Just the electromagnetic interactions of dipole water molecules acting under rapid cooling form symmetric objects of wonder. They look like Christmas ornaments, and if we didn't know better, we'd assumed they were carefully designed by a master artist." End quote. Atheists like Dawkins and Krauss, who have examined the cosmos in great detail, have attempted to describe, without God, why the universe and life within it look so designed. A multitude of natural explanations abound, not unlike Scrooge's natural explanations for Marley's ghost, maybe a bit of undigested beef, a spot of mustard, an undone potato, protons, neutrons, electrons, mysterious unknown forces, whatever they may be. May it be that anything but this dreadful apparition of God that is ever present before me. And what about Scripture? Whatever one might say of the Bible, there is also clearly intentionality and design behind its composition. Why do we even have such a collection of writings in the first place? Can they be trusted? Do they record actual history? Did Jesus of Nazareth really exist, and did he really rise bodily from the grave? Is the resurrection of Jesus merely an amalgam of myths or the hallucinations of Jesus' bereaved disciples, who allegedly really only saw a ghost or some other sort of illusory apparition? The Bible, however, is clear. Jesus isn't a ghost, unlike Jacob Marley or the textual apparitions of liberal critics and skeptics. Jesus really did rise bodily from the grave and appear to his disciples and many others in the flesh. As Jesus says to his disciples in Luke's account, quote, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and feet. While they still could not believe it because of their joy and amazement, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" He gave them a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it before them. End quote. Jesus was not a bit of undigested beef, but he ate a bit of fish. Jesus rose bodily from the grave, breaking the chains of death that could not hold him. He comes to each one of us in our own rooms with a message of hope and redemption, not to terrify or to trouble us, but to give us rest. The cosmos, human life, and the scriptures were all created with purpose and intention through and for the Lord Jesus Christ. But how do we communicate gospel truth in a world that seems to have completely lost any conceptual understanding of not only truth, but even of common sense itself? Our guest again this week, apologist and best-selling author Greg Kochel, gives us some practical and encouraging insights as to how we can begin meaningful conversations with non-believers about the cosmos and the reliability and trustworthiness of Scripture. As we begin part two, I ask Greg how we might be able to engage skeptics about the bigger questions they raise regarding the universe. Here once again is Greg Kochel.
There's so many ways to approach this, Daniel, that are interesting, I think. The cosmos is a lot bigger than us, but it's also a lot smaller than us, too. And I've actually never done the math on this, but I have a suspicion that if you think of subatomic particles, you think of the size of particles in the quantum world and the size of the universe, that not that this is significant, I'll explain why in a moment, but it is kind of curious that I suspect we're somewhere very close to being in the middle in terms of size.
Okay? Yeah, I've heard that before. So
people making the big deal that, you know, when you think of the size of the universe, that we are just cosmically insignificant, inconsequential. Right. This was Carl Sagan's point when he reflected on the pale blue dot.
Yes.
You know, when the Voyager 1 kind of looked over its shoulder at what it was leaving, and there was the pale blue dot of the Earth way off in the distance. See how inconsequential we are. Of course, that presumes that size equates with significance. That's the presumption.
And that's the fallacy, yes.
That's the fallacy there. Ironically, you said that you mentioned about Copernicus dethroning us. Copernicus was a Christian.
Yes.
And so was Galileo.
Right.
Just about every single one. Newton was a Christian. You know, Boyle was a Christian. Just about every one of those founders of ancient science.
You listed those in your book, Street Smarts.
I did.
Yeah, that was great.
In response, to kind of put in perspective of this science versus religion faux combat, basically, that's going on. It's contrived. It's not real.
Right.
But it's real in people's mind. But there is kind of a cosmic dysphoria, to use your term, which is great, that people experience agoraphobia. It's like so big and we're so small, then we feel inconsequential. And that would be true on an atheist worldview, molecules in motion, but even then it has nothing to do with size.
Mm-hmm.
We could be the biggest thing in the universe.
Right.
And that wouldn't make us significant if all you had was molecules in motion.
Right.
Richard Dawkins, the most famous atheist in the world right now, put it, that it's nothing but, there's no good, there's no evil, nothing but blind, indifferent,
blind,
pitiless indifference. Pitiless indifference, yeah. But he's accurately describing the atheist world.
Mm-hmm.
The value that follows from atheism, okay? It's what I call nothingism, which is my popular way of saying nihilism.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing. There is no good, no evil, no, as he put it. There's no significance. There's no consequence ultimately to anyone, anything. There's no ultimate value. And now a lot of atheists say, well, I don't care if there's ultimate. I can make my own world. Okay. I said, you can make your own value. You do what's valuable for you. Okay. So does Drake, the sex trafficker. He's doing what's valuable for him.
Right.
So are you telling me that you're on par with him? Now, of course, that's exactly what's going on. But notice how I used a question. It's not rhetorical. When I ask these questions of other people, I'm waiting for their response. Because the atheist is going to say, if he says, I have a more noble point of view here than he does, I'll say, where are you getting your standard that qualifies your view as noble and his as ignoble?
Mm-hmm.
Because in atheism, there is no transcendent standard. If the standard is just in him, well, I feel it's more noble, then Drake feels his is more noble than yours. And so you're still at par.
Right.
There is in that worldview, and this is a serious problem with atheism, that in Street Smarts I talk about and then give dialogues with leading questions that can help the Christian to expose. And that's really the point of Street Smarts. We don't go out in the street, physically speaking, because we feel, especially in some neighborhoods, vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The street is wherever you feel vulnerable. You feel at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Christians feel vulnerable and at risk in conversations about spiritual things. It may not be in the street. It could be with friends. It could be with professors. It could be with family members. But when it comes to spiritual matters, now they're vulnerable. And so they shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want them to see is it's possible to get street smart by understanding the flaw in a challenge to Christianity or a flaw in somebody else's worldview. We were talking about atheism just a moment ago. And once you see the flaw, then you move to the third step of the game plan, which is using questions to make a point.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been role modeling here is you and I have been talking, Daniel, is how when some of these things come up, I have these questions in my toolbox, so to speak, or in my garden box, I guess. I don't know
how
you'd want to characterize it. And I can bring them out because I know what's going on there. I see the flaw, which is what I help the readers understand, whether it's atheism or abortion or problems with the Bible or the person of Jesus or things like that, gender, sex, marriage. Then here are the questions. I help them to see the flaws, the readers, and then here are the questions you can ask to lead that person, whoever's offering the objection or alternate point of view. down a road of thinking to help them to see the flaw.
Yeah, yeah. And I love this question approach because you and I, last year we talked about, and I know you've talked about it in the past, street epistemology, where atheists are finding the efficacy of asking questions as well,
sure,
and applying these to their conversations for the purpose of causing doubt in a Christian's worldview or a spiritualist right. worldview. But Greg, yeah. I thought with the time we have remaining, this comes up in addition to the cosmological issues, your book outlines some great questions for that, and readers can refer to the book and you can see how you've unpacked with conversation. That's a wonderful thing. It's not highly technical. It's not super scientific. It's just very basic along the level of where people can converse on the street, if you will, in relation mm-hmm. to these questions. But I thought another objection that comes up a lot, especially in the atheist and Christian dialogue, is the reliability of the Gospels and or the New Testament, that they are not mm-hmm. trustworthy. There's a whole body of popular scholarship led by Bart Ehrman, and yeah. and others who have brought to bear a great deal of scholarly criticism of the Bible. And this is also intimidating. We mm-hmm. had Dr. Ehrman on our Atheist and Christian Book Club a couple of years ago. I yeah. asked him one question, and he ripped me up one side and down the other. And but my friend who debated him told me he would do that, and he said, stick to your ground, don't answer his red herrings. But what it looked like mm-hmm. on camera was that I didn't know how to answer the questions. What right, I was really right. doing is that I wasn't going to answer the questions, though I could. And I tried to hold him to the initial question of what's the best explanation for why we have the New Testament if Jesus didn't rise from the dead?
Right.
He did not like that question at right. all. But I bring that up, Greg, to your point of how important asking the right and poignant questions in these mm-hmm. conflicts and dialogues that we have with people. I kind of liken street smarts to what I would call conversational warfare, that you're in warfare, but it's a conversation. And you recognize...
Yeah, with a smile.
Yeah, you recognize kind of where you're at with that. And that's what it felt like talking to Dr. Ehrman, even for 10
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah.
But to the point that a really good question can bring out the problems of the worldview without actually saying you're wrong and here's why. Here's a question mm-hmm. that reveals the flaws in what you're thinking. Could you mm-hmm. maybe briefly address
speak
New
to
Testament?
Some of that. Sure.
To some of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do have a chapter dealing with some of the challenges, particularly the Old Testament, and also some of the challenges with science in the Bible. I can't cover everything street
oh,
smarts,
sure.
of course, but
right.
this is a good opportunity to take the principles and apply them to the Bart Ehrman thing, who I do cite in my favor, actually, with regards to one issue that's very, very important, you know, because in a sense, he is a ideological friendly in a way that most people don't think. Now, Bart Ehrman is a scholar at the top of his field in textual criticism. He was a colleague of Bruce Metzger, who was his mentor. Bruce was the best in the world. He passed away in 2005. And ironically, they reissued the text of the New Testament that Bruce had written. And then Bart was involved with this. They both co-authored it. And they made one statement in that academic text. And then the same year he released Misquoting Jesus, Bart Ehrman did, where he kind of tried to play the other side of the coin.
Yes.
You can't rely. So in two texts that his name is on and coming out the same year, he says kind of two different things.
Right.
So with regards to the reliability of the Bible, now that question requires more clarification. So if somebody says, well, how do we know the Bible's reliable? So my first question in our game plan, gathering information, is what do you mean by that? So I'm going to ask a question. Well, in what sense are you saying it's are you asking if it's reliable? Are you talking about the textual transmission? Are you talking about whether it's inspired in by God and inerrant? Or are you asking whether the history is reliable that we read, say, in the Gospels? Or are you asking whether the information about God that it gives and worldview are reliable? Those are all separate things. And just for the record, I do not debate the issue of inerrancy at all with non-believers. It's a dead end. It's not important. It's not necessary, because we can make the point based on the historical reliability of the Gospels. And this is where Bart Ehrman comes in, because I cite this in the book and then give the footnote. They can go to the video and watch it themselves. He is talking, he has given a talk. Of course, you got a lot of atheist types that are there. And one atheist raises the point during the Q&A. He says, I don't see any historical evidence for the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And of course, this guy's what's called a Jesus mythicist. Okay, Jesus, just a myth, you know, a cobbling together of ancient mythology, you know, and that's where this gospel account comes from. And I'm telling you, Barterman jumps out right on top of him. He says, well, I do. In other words, I see historical evidence. I wrote a whole book on it. And there's the reason why we trust that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the primary source documentation of the life of Jesus, plus Josephus and some other things. He said, we have early sources. There are multiple sources. They corroborate each other. We even know about Jesus, somebody who knew Jesus' brother. You know, he's going on and on about this stuff. And then he tells the atheists, he says, there is not an academic in the world that is lettered in this area, ancient Near Eastern history and the gospel time, that believes what you just said. And quit talking like that because you sound like an idiot. I mean, that's a summary of what he said at the end, but it's pretty close. So here we've got a guy who's a critic of Christianity and a critic of the textual transmission, who still, even with the textual concerns that he writes about, is convinced that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John give us reliable history about the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, so the question I would ask, first one is, what do you mean by reliable? Okay, what of those categories? And one point, one of the points that I make to people, and again, this is a question: do you have any books in your library? Yeah, of course they do. Do they tell you anything that's true? Of course they do. Are any of those books written by God? No, of course not. So in other words, a book doesn't have to be written by God to give you true information about something, does it? No. Okay, now I've just shifted the whole discussion, haven't I, to the New Testament documents and their historical reliability, not their divine inspiration, which when you argue that way, you invite a cascade of objections and potential conflicts or inconsistencies or whatever, contradictions, whatever. I just want to sidestep that whole thing. And then I could say, you know, Bart Ehrman is. Bart Ehrman is one of the biggest critics of the Bible. All right. And then I said, then I'll mention that his comment that I just made to you, and that's all in the book. But there's also the great writer, Will Durant, who wrote the most popular work of history in history, The Story of Civilization. It's got a whole book on Caesar and the Christ. And there's a statement that's in the Street Smarts about his acknowledging the reliability of those from an historical perspective. So I might say, you ever hear Will Durant, his wife Ariel wrote the series with him. Now, if the issue is, what about textual transmission? You know, it's really curious about Bart Ehrman. Because he makes a big fuss about all the errors in the Bible, right? And all, I should say, not so much errors, but all the variants in the Bible. They're more variants than there are words in the Bible, in the New Testament. Oh my goodness. I mean, this throws everybody for a loop. But it's very interesting because at the end of his book, misquoting Jesus, he has a section that says 10 verses that are not in the Bible. Okay, and then he gives you the verses. There was nothing in there that surprised me when I read it, because everybody knows that these are variants that are not reliable. But how does Bart Ehrman know that these things are not in the original text? Because he has a tool called textual criticism that allows him to winnow the wheat from the chaff so you can get down to what the original text actually said. We have the tools that allow us to get rid of this stuff, and that's what he's doing. So in a certain sense, the appendix undermines the entire claim that he's making in the rest of the book. We can figure it out. And it turns out that almost the vast majority of these, like 98% of these variants, are completely inconsequential to anything important. And he'll acknowledge that himself. So these are the kinds of things that I would use to, I would put that information in question format with people, or I'd even ask Bart Ehrman, how do you know that these 10 things are not in there? Well, because of textual criticism. So you have a tool that will allow you to winnow the wheat from the chaff, right? Yes. So then why can't we trust the New Testament documents? You know, this is the, and incidentally, in his popular work, he is much more loosey-goosey with the facts than he is with his academic work, which he knows is going to be juried by peers.
Right, right.
And so he's much more careful. So those are the kinds of questions you might ask in a circumstance like that.
That's excellent. I mean, his work with Metzger is phenomenally sound. Frank Turek has given presentations where he says, his book with Dr. Metzger is great. His popular work, not so much.
Yes, right.
And
he has taken to task by other scholars like Michael Kona and the like for that inconsistency.
Yeah. I've seen a few discussions with Dr. Ehrman and Dan Wallace, who's...
Dan's another one, right.
Dan just kind of holds his feet to the fire about, from the scholarly perspective, about...
And Dan's very tough. About he knows these, his stuff.
Right, right. And so I appreciate your time, Greg. I appreciate your insight. Your book is Street Smarts, Using Questions to Answer Christianity's Toughest Challenges. I thought I'd ask a closing question, then we'll wrap up. I mentioned at the beginning my new friend I met here at the coffee shop. What would be a good question she could ask her atheist brother or father about their atheism and about all the people? Like, one of the objections is all the people out there that aren't Christians. What about them? How can we? Because that's really what we're trying to do, Greg, when we're gardening.
Sure.
We want to.
Sure.
We have the garden of unbelief out there before us. This is one of the entrance exams, if you will, to that gardening process. What role do these people have in our lives? How are they going to hear the gospel? What do we do?
There's a couple things going on there. And there's a fairly straightforward answer that comes out of Romans chapter 1. So I'm just going to give the backstory here. And the backstory is that even though everyone has not heard about Jesus, everybody has heard about the Father. They haven't heard about the Son, who is the solution, but they have heard about the Father. Okay. And that's what Paul says. He says that that there is some witness from the outside, that which has been made. This is Romans 1:18 and following, that God's mad, and he's mad because his evidence is his presence is evident to everybody through what's been made. And also there's something inside of them that bears testimony. He made it evident within them, Paul says. But instead of honoring God as God, they turn their backs on him because of unrighteousness, because of rebellion. They suppress the obvious truth. Think about, people look at the world, or atheists, they say, wow, it's so cool. Isn't Mother Nature amazing? Wait a minute. Why are you talking about mother? It's father. Oh, no, there's no father. It's mother. Well, why do you say mother? Well, they say that because it looks like somebody's monkeying with things, right? But they that's just a figure of speech. Well, wait a minute. There's a reason you chose that kind of figure, because it's the, just as Richard Dawkins says, the biological world is a complex world that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So part of the when we go have these conversations, we can trust that there's a lot of evidence, the fingerprints of God everywhere, okay? And I might pursue a line of questioning about the atheism that way. But back to the challenge about what about those who have never heard, the simplest way to put it, I think, without getting in, if just giving an answer, is that God is going to judge people based on the revelation they have been given, all right? That's how God's going to judge people, on the revelation they have been given, okay? Now, we learn in Romans 1 that Paul says just the revelation to the Father that's given regarding the Father is enough for them to be guilty. They are without excuse. But I heard an illustration once that helps to make sense of the idea. If you reject the Father, he doesn't owe you the Son. If you reject the Father, he doesn't owe you more revelation. Let's just say, you know, somebody had, you were going to offer somebody some money. So if I gave you $2 and you chose not to accept it, you said, I'm not taking your $2. Okay. Would it be fair or incumbent upon me to offer you 10? If you shined on the $2, why should I offer you 10? You've already said no. Maybe I got more I could have offered you, but because you've been, in a certain sense, rude right off the bat or whatever, then I'm not going to give you the 10. Well, there's a parallel here, I think. Notice the questions. And what the questions often do is they're geared to get a common sense intuitive response out of a person. And then we use that intuitive response as a springboard to make the point about a spiritual thing. And so the same way God has showed himself, obviously, in so many different ways. The design is so evident that people come up with the multiverse to try to explain away design. But there's no evidence for the multiverse. It's just a way of offering some very far-fetched alternative to the straightforward, obvious explanation of design in the universe, that a designer did it, you know? And by the way, the design problem is what Richard Dawkins says is one of the most difficult ones for him to deal with as an atheist. Basically, he says, we just got lucky. That's right. What his response was.
Well, I've seen him say over and over again, or not over and over again, but it's in the God delusion, certainly, and things he said publicly, that the biological life of the universe has the apparent illusion of design. Yeah. So he's forced to acknowledge.
Yeah, that's a blind watchmaker.
Yeah, blind watchmaker. Thank you.
He's first sentence of the book is what he said.
Okay, I got to go back and read that. Yeah, I got to go back and read that. But that he's forced to concede. Yeah, it looks designed. Sure does. You know.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what Romans 1 is saying, that there's that suppression of the truth and unrighteousness, which I think Christians and non-Christians alike, we're all guilty of it in some way in that regard.
I agree with you. We're human beings, and that's the nature of the fall. It's precisely what we need to be rescued from, because as Paul says there in Romans 1, actually says it twice, I think, they are without excuse, which means we are without excuse.
Right.
And it's precisely why we need to have a rescuer. And that rescuer is God with us, Emmanuel, Jesus of Nazareth.
Thank you for joining us again this week. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Greg Kokel. If your interest was stirred about how you might better respond to criticisms and skepticism leveled at the Bible and its historical reliability, be sure to tune in for the next 2 weeks, as I will be discussing Jesus, Skepticism, and the Problem of History with Senior Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary, Dr. Daryl Buck. Merry Christmas to you and your family from all of us here at Watchman Fellowship for Apologetics Profile. I'm Staff Apologist Daniel Ray.